It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your story clerk.
Thank you, everybody, for adjusting with the time change. I hate schedules. I hate travel. I hate fires from Canada that cause travel to change and then schedules change. But anyhow, we are so happy everybody's with us for Chatter. We have a really wonderful show this evening, and I'm going to resist the urge to make it all about horses all the time, because our author is Nani Kwame Adjei-Brenya, really, really remarkable young person, our second Syracuse author in a row, as a matter of fact. And his book is Chain Gang All-Stars. And I kept trying, it's just a fascinating book. And I kept trying to think, okay, it's Hunger Games crossed with, you know, what? And I couldn't do justice to it, but it's Hunger Games crossed with The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which is a fantastic book, but it's remarkable in and of itself. But in the meantime, we have Claude Jennings doing all the important work. We have David Aldridge doing the next most important work. Lily Martin, intern extraordinaire, who is now known as our content manager. And my favorite reporter of all time in the New York Times these days, Joe Drape. Welcome, everybody. Joe, welcome back, my friend. You've been very busy.
Tori, it's not been the triple crown that we all like to see. Good for journalists. Horse racing is a gift that just keeps giving year in and year out.
It is. And we're going to spend some time on it. We got to do some stupid book stuff, you know, right here in the early part of the show. We'll come back to this a lot. But I want you to update us, because I'm now getting obsessed with it, with your book, Black Maestro, which came out some years ago. Tell us about the story of Black Maestro and the status of it, because I know it got optioned a long time ago, right?
Yes. Jimmy Wingfield, the last African-American jockey to win the Kentucky Derby, 1902, had this Forrest Gump life in the Russian Empire, rode for the Tsar, stayed 268 horses in this lonesome dove sort of drive to Poland during the revolution, lands in France as a king again, but gets run out in World War II, has to come back to the States, works as in the WPA program, then goes down south and has to live in a stall with his son, makes enough money to get it all back in France. He gets honored at the 50th anniversary. Sports Illustrated has a lunch for him at the Brown Hotel in Louisville the day before the Derby, and he can't walk in the front door. So it's a very much sort of an epic tale. And Sony has bought it. Uh-huh. They bought the pilot and what I call the Bible, what they call the Bible for a series. It was... Uh-huh. It's been hooked up with two far better filmmakers than me, and that was very encouraging. And then we were supposed to put it out in March to start pitching streamers and networks, and here comes the strike, so it's on pause. And I got a letter from a lawyer that I never would ever imagine would come to me, invoking force majeure, which is... Something happened in nature, so they got to stop it, and my option will kick in once the writer's strike stops. But we're hopeful. Wow. I mean, there's a lot of good people involved.
Okay, it's got to happen. It's got to happen in our lifetime, Joe, because at some time, at some point in the lifetime of Chatter on Books, David and Claude and, you know, Lily, if she hangs in there with us, but she's going to ditch us in about 4 weeks, are going to go to premiere of a book we've talked of the movie of a book we've talked about on this show. So I'm pinning my hopes on this one.
Tell me, I got a kid going to college in August. So it needs to happen sooner or later.
I'm sorry. They're calling the writer's strike a force of nature.
A force majeure, something that was unforeseen.
Yikes. Okay.
Isn't
all right.
The reason that the insurance companies don't pay up when a hurricane comes through? We didn't know.
Right. Yeah. Pretty much.
Okay. I got to do an email because this is from our friend David, who we love. And David Aldridge, I'll tell you later who this David is. Okay. But this came in a few weeks ago when we did the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which mercifully this year was under 100 degrees. So it was kind of tolerable. It was great. And we got an opportunity to spend some time with Teresa Runstetler, who really amazing person, who had written a great book called Blackball, just loosely about Spencer Haywood, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, et cetera, got an email about that show saying, today's podcast, Teresa, fantastic guest. Tori and the gang, I will keep this short. Today's podcast was absolutely fantastic. It was like a Ken Burns documentary, educational and enlightening. Thank you. I've never missed a show. David. God bless you, David. Okay, David Aldridge, Claude, we're now being compared to Ken Burns.
Yeah, but we don't have the treacly, you know, music in the background. And
have you guys ever heard
Joe? The top of the Reds head, Rebels heads, your son Jeb.
Have you guys ever heard my rant about Ken Burns documentaries? Well, first of all, let's just start with the hair. Let's just start with Ken Burns' hair. If you are successful and have made as much money as Ken Burns had, deservedly, because anybody who can make money off the backs of PBS, God bless him, he's got the worst haircut in the planet. And I'm thinking, I could do better. But anyways, no, here is a Ken Burns documentary. Imagine, if you will, the boot of a soldier in the Civil War. And you don't know, is he a Confederate? Is he a Union soldier? But it's a crusty, cracked, dried out boot. And that music is playing in the background.
Yeah,
fiddles. And then the camera does the most painstakingly slow pan up to, wait for it, the knee. That is the essence of a Ken Burns documentary. It's all you need to know. Slowest pans in the history of cinematography. Okay. All right. But David, thank you for that. Okay, Dolly, David Aldridge, can we talk about Dolly? And what you sent me last week?
Yes, of course. It's your show.
Well, do you remember what it was?
Yes. Now, every child in California under 5 can now get free books, which is awesome because of Dolly Parton.
This is the most amazing thing. Rave about Dolly all the time, understandably so. And as I said to David last week, now that Tina's dead, I mean, I've got like one goddess left in my life.
Wow.
And by the way, when Dolly goes, you'll never hear from me again. But this, she started this Imagination Library, just to remind everybody, years ago, in honor of her father, who was illiterate. And despite all her success as a singer, as a performer, as everything else, Dollywood, which is spectacular, if you've never been, he came to her before he died and said, this Imagination Library, which is now given away for free, over 200 million books worldwide, is the best thing you've ever done. And it is. I mean, she's becoming, you think about what Jose Andres does, you know, like the rest of the world is spinning around and global organizations can't get their, you know, they get wrapped around the axle when there's a hurricane, there's some disaster. And Jose Andres and people just go in there and they're feeding people. We talk about all these challenges and the need for literacy and everything else. She just does it. Mm-hmm. Just amazing. Absolutely amazing. Okay.
A remarkable woman who's done very much for us.
Incredible.
She really has. And her, okay. Continuing with Dolly, her album, this latest album that she has coming out with all the duets, she's the first person ever who convinced Paul McCartney and Ringo to perform again together.
Wow.
They're on one of the singles with her on that album.
Yeah.
That in and of itself. It's pretty remarkable. Okay. I think that's my book news. Okay. Joe, you ready to talk about Racing Buddy?
Sure. Yeah. Eventful 5 weeks, not all great for the sport that I know you admire and follow. And you know, I've done this 25 years, Tori, so I always say their social license is about ready to be canceled. But I think this time I truly mean it. And, you know, you heard 7 hit dead horses on the way to Churchill, the Derby. Two Derby Day, unexplained, 5 more after that. We moved to the Preakness. And, you know, it's too bad because that took away from a wonderful Kentucky Derby win by Javier Castellano, one of the, you know, true craftsmen, 45 years old, that they've tried to leave for dead several times. He'd never won the Derby, did it on the 16th try. So that gets eclipsed there. We move to Baltimore in the Preakness. Bob Baffert's return to the Triple Crown Trail after his horse Medina Spirit gets disqualified for a drug violation. in the Derby after winning it 2021, 2 year ban. I shouldn't skip over. Medina Spirit eventually dies 5 months later. He comes back early in the card. Another one of his colts, horse called Having a Meltdown, had a horrible fall in an earlier race. And you know it as a horse person. It was one of those worst ones where they get up and try to run afterwards, and they had to bring the screen out and put them down right there on the track in front of, 100,000 people in a national television audience. That gets us into number two, and that eclipsed. And then Bob comes back and wins the Preakness Baffert. And, that's pretty much the better and worse of horse racing was wrapped up in about 3 hours right there.
I have to tell you, when Baffert won, oh my God, this is so inside baseball, you guys. I knew you were busy, Joe, so I didn't email, text you, call, screaming, because I just didn't want to see his horse win. I mean, we could go on and on about Baffert and Pletcher, these, top trainers. And there's cheating in every sport and in every industry. But, man, I didn't want to see him vindicated in any way.
Well, man, if you don't want that to happen, be one of his owners and quit doing it. I mean, the remarkable thing about him is he's had this record. Almost 88 horses died under his care, 30 drug violations. But he's won two triple crowns, tied for the most Kentucky Derbies. And the remarkable thing to me is that his owners stay with him. And these are the deepest pocketed owners who are supposed to stand for integrity. Barbara Bonnke is the head of the Breeders' Cup. She's from the Kendall Jackson fortune. She stays with him. The Soros Fund, the some outshoot of George Soros' fortune, he's with her, with him. It stops when people decide to hold everybody else accountable. A lot like society, a lot like life. You can do the parallel of politics and the division in our nation right now. But that's kind of what it is. It's a microcosm there.
I promise anybody who's still listening to Chatter on Horses, I really should start that podcast. That'd be great. in the part of the industry that I do, which is hunters, jumpers, etc., it's nowhere near as bad, but there's abuse and there's cheating and people drug in the hunters where they want everything to be beautiful and wonderful. They drug the horses to make them quieter. In the jumpers, they give them performance enhancing, et cetera. And there's a system where if somebody gets busted, if a trainer gets busted, they can get set down, right? But the horse doesn't get set down, meaning they might be suspended for 6 months or whatever. But the horse doesn't get set down and the owner doesn't get penalized. And unless and until, Joe, the owner gets penalized or their horse can't compete. Because what they do in my part of the world is if a trainer gets set down for 6 months, a year, whatever it is, they just move the horse to another barn and the horse keeps going. Like they move back, people move Baffert's horses if they want them to run in Kentucky, et cetera, where he was banned. But unless and until they ban, they suspend the horse and punish the owners, they're not going to change, right?
I couldn't agree with you more. And it's even more, I guess, laughable. They get 15 days, $2,000 fine. They don't even have to move a horse out of the barn. They can just say guilty, pay for it, put it in their assistant's name, and onward they go. So, Neil Drysdale, who's a friend and a great trainer, has won the Derby with APND, came from England, older guy. And he said, horse racing is so much about ego, and these owners spend this money to hoist the biggest trophy. And basically, they do it on the come. They don't have to, if he doesn't win, nobody knows who they are. If something bad happens to it, nothing happens. I mean, I would aim it all. I'm with you. Aim it all at the owners. Your bully pulpit, shame them, basically.
Yeah. And then, David, I've got a question for you. But first, I'll continue to rant. What I talk about, because I'm getting older and older every single day, is the world in which I operate used to be a bunch of people who loved their horses and liked the horse show, as I call it. It's called horse shows. like the horse show. And now it is overwhelmingly dominated by people who love the horse show and they like their horses. And they spend 2-3 months in Wellington, Florida, which is essentially Miami, Palm Beach, and they're uber wealthy. And if two or three of their horses work, Joe, great. And if they don't, then they just toss them aside and bring another few up, right? They're like sets of skis. They're not right. These living, breathing creatures who give it their hearts and souls and lives for us sometime. David, is there, I hate being this cynical. There's corruption and everything in every sport and every industry for that matter. But is it as bad or as cynical as this in other sports?
Depends on the sport. I mean, every sport, like, you know, you don't really think guys play football every week for 12 years and they just do it out of their incredible athletic ability.
Right. So we talked about that with Teresa Ronsettler at the,
yeah. festival. I mean, yeah. Look, every sport has drugs. Every sport has performance enhancing drugs. You know, whether it's basketball players smoking weed or baseball players taking uppers or whatever it is, they've all got them. So it's not like it's a new thing.
Is cycling the worst?
All I said about cycling was this. If everybody in cycling got busted for cheating and the guy that beat all of them wasn't cheating, like, that doesn't make any sense. Like,
right.
That's all I said about that was, wait a minute, everybody who cycles gets busted for doping. And this one guy who wins 7 times isn't doping? Seriously? Like, okay. So that lasted for a while.
Okay. Here's the difference, though. Here's the difference. Supposedly, smart, mature human beings can make those decisions for themselves, free will. The horses can't.
That's the one thing.
Horses can't.
Makes it worse.
And I could drill down so deep on this, what they do to young horses to get them ready for the 2-year-old sales, it's awful. And these horses, one of the best things, one of the worst things about horses is they have these incredible hearts and they will die for you. They will run until they die and they have no free will. You know, they don't have free will.
Yeah. Okay. That very much is the two things it has to reckon with is, are horses sentient beings or are they livestock? And, those are two different approaches, and both are alive right there in horse racing, even in the show horsing at that point. I mean, if he doesn't work out, get a better one. Get rid of him. Yep. Get a bit better one.
Yeah. No, I love it. In my part of the world, when people say, I never have these concerns. My horse loves to do this. It's like, bullshit. Your horse loves to go back to his field and eat grass and poop. If you opened his stall door, he would not go into a small enclosed space and start jumping jumps. They just won't do that. It's not their favorite thing to do. They allow us to ask them to do this. It's remarkable. Okay, but let's end on I hope two high notes. First of all, every single time there's a Triple Crown race, Derby, Preakness, Belmont, Joe, I think about, and then I go back and watch Secretariat. As far as I'm concerned, the time in the Belmont the other day was several seconds behind his stratospheric win when he won the Triple Crown, right?
Oh, yeah. He's got the track record. And David and I have talked about this before on here. There is just once-in-a-lifetime transcendent performances. That was one of them.
Yeah.
And, that transcends all athletics. I mean, there's other
things. I agree.
And, it was the 50th anniversary. And it made us remember that horses could be pure. They could run fast. They could celebrate. Yeah. The trivia question is, what athlete appeared on the cover of Newsweek, Time, Sports Illustrated, and the New York Times? And Secretariat is the only one who's gotten that grand slam. So, but that was a time where it was the only game in town. People loved gambling wise, people love their horses and horse racing. It wasn't beamed in television all the time. You couldn't sit on your couch and bet on it, watch it on a screen. You had to actually get up and go to the track and watch an athlete perform. So that made it a lot different.
Yep. Spectacular. It makes me, every time I watch the Belmont, it makes me cry. Secretary's Belmont. Okay. So to really get us out on a high note, talk about what happened at last Saturday's Belmont, though, which was like a little brief, this is nice moment.
Total brief. Jenna Antonucci, a young woman, became the first female winner of 155 years of Triple Crown races. She does it the old-fashioned way, small barn, mostly all women, worked for her, takes her time. She didn't push this horse. In fact, to even get them into Belmont, they had to supplement $50,000 to get a spot in the starting gate. And, you know, it only had four runs. The horse was bought for $35,000. So, like, for 2 minutes and 7 seconds, she beat all the money guys. And it really was sort of the grace note the sport needed. And, you know, we need those a lot more. But then again, this being horse racing, it can't be totally lollipops and rainbows. The next race, a horse died in the deal. I mean, it just, they can't get out of the way of themselves.
Yeah, the highs and lows are extraordinary. And I find myself when I watch now, and I keep saying, I'm not going to watch. And then I do. And I found myself watching the Belmont like this going, just don't break down. I just want to watch a horse break down. And then her story, really pretty remarkable. So why doesn't somebody, if there are any of those old remaining, that chatter on racing continues with Lily, David, Claude, and Joe Drape. Thank you for joining us. Why doesn't somebody throw, you know, money, people love money. Why doesn't somebody throw some money at a series that supports and gives money to horses that race as 6, 7, 8 year olds, right? I mean, there's so much money. I get it, in the breeding, et cetera. You know, have the horse win a few races and then get out and get the stud fees. But somebody could throw not so much money and create the initiative, the support, if you will, for horses to hang in there for a few years, because then you'd have more trainers like that woman who would say, I'm not going to push them. I'm going to take some time.
Well, and this is for another longer podcast. In Europe, in the steeplechases, that's what they do. These horses are followed around like teams. They race, they don't even get to the track and then jump in 2 miles until they're 5 years old. They race till they're 11. I had the good, you know, to get over there. What's the big one?
Grand National.
Not the Grand National, though. Irish versus Europe. I'm having my senior moments right
now. Sure.
But like, people do follow these horses and, like, knew exactly who they were and would follow them to the track and back. And, you know, it was wonderful. So, yes, I don't know why. I know why they don't do it, because, you know, I did a story about Flightline. If you can run 6 times, go undefeated, and then go into the breeding shed and make 200,000 for 17 seconds. It was 17.2 exactly of copulation. You know, he made more in 11 days than he did his whole career. He quadrupled his earnings to this point so far. Do that times four. He's going to make 140 million in 4 years before any of his offspring ever run.
Okay. I realize that, you know, of our 18 million listeners, 17 million of them have checked out by now. David, you would say to yourself, there's no way Tori can bring this back to me, but I will.
Sure.
I believe that the changes, no, I will. I believe the changes in the NFL over the years, protect the quarterback, have helped sport. Because so many players move around. It's, you know, I grew up in the 70s, 80s in Pittsburgh, and it was so easy to be addicted to a team. But when players move around, it's less easy. But if you can get attached to a player because he plays for a long time, you know, I went from hating Tom Brady to being one of his biggest fans. Mm-hmm. So supporting the older athlete is good for a sport overall, don't you think?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it is. But I don't, you know, I'm a bit cynical about this. I don't know that.
Shocked.
Yeah, that anybody really is looking out for the older athletes. I mean, in the sense that,
so?
No, I think in the sense that they look they look out for anybody that makes money for them, whether they're 42 or 22. And so that helps. If they can help Tom Brady, they will. If they can help the rookie that's spectacular, they'll help the rookie too. Like, I just don't, there's no benevolism, if that's a word, in professional sports. There's no benevolent behavior. It's all about how can we make as much money as humanly possible. And whatever.
Okay, but we want to make a lot of money over a long period of time. And I know plenty of people like me, this is highly scientific, people like me who, you know, grew up hating New England for lots of different reasons. But over time, you kind of go, wow, Brady just keeps showing up, showing up, showing up. There is a whole category of more mature viewers out there, amateur football fans who hung in there because you got attached to him. And we wouldn't have done that if he had had a 5-year career versus 40 years.
Well, I don't think the NFL had much to do with Tom Brady's longevity. I think Tom Brady was more responsible for that by the lifestyle he led and the decisions he made. And I'll just leave it there.
Does he ever come back? Does he ever come back?
I doubt it. I don't think so. I think I believe him. He says he's done. I think he's done. It's hard to go out there every week, especially at a certain age. It's tough. It's hard to get ready. It's hard to take that physical punishment. It's physical punishment to play football. Yeah.
Despite being protected.
It's very difficult. So I would
say, by the way, my wife and I watched 80 for Brady, the movie with Lily Tomlin. It was remarkably warm and funny, and he was the worst actor in there.
Well,
but it's worth it 90 minutes.
All right.
Nana, you may have been signed up to do Chatter on Books, but this is really Chatter on Sports with David.
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Lily, the intern.
I have not followed anything they've been saying.
Lily now knows more about what's going on in the NBA Finals than she ever wanted to know. And horse racing.
It's everybody.
Okay.
Denver Nuggets.
There you go.
It's their year.
Probably going to end tonight. Yep.
Probably going to be. And people want to watch it. So, Nani, thank you so much for joining Chatter on Books. Glad we could have you. You're looking very techie. People can't see because this is a podcast, but it looks like you're in, you know, NASA. The book is Chain Gang All-Stars, and we will spend a lot of time on it, but we want to hear a little bit about you, and I got to get to Syracuse pretty quickly, but your father was a criminal defense attorney. Did I read that right?
Yes, he was.
So what got you as a child down the writing path versus the lawyer path? And how did your dad feel about it?
I'm sure there was a time where they both would have liked to, both my parents would have had the same question for me. I think that my father was a lawyer. My mother was a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that seeing at a younger age, my mother got sick and she wasn't able to work as much. And a lot of like their financial situation, the house was sort of like really strained. And I guess I had like a practical example of doing the sort of like safe route or that kind of way, not really working or being sort of still arising in like ending up in like a kind of harshness. So, which is like what people tell you, like about trying to do like something like being a writer. So, I mean, obviously choosing to be a writer as a means to like, find financial liberation is an insane idea, but I just decided I was going to try to do something I actually liked. And my parents, it wasn't so much asking. I was kind of like, I think they're like, Nana likes reading, so that's good. And I think they figured he's going to be, even when I was in MFA, it was like, Nana's a professor. You know, that's how they thought about it. And by the time my book was out, I was like, the joke I used to say is, I finally figured out how to get your very immigrant parents to agree with your life as an artist. And all I had to do was get a profile in the New York Times. That's how I think about it.
That's all. And see your books in bookstores. They got to see your books in bookstores, right?
They did.
Which is a real deal. Real deal. Joe, I forget. What did your parents think when you, your dad, I know, died, but your family, what did they think about you becoming a journalist? Did they go, oh, my God?
They just were glad I wasn't in Rikers at that point.
There you go. Yeah, low bar. Set that.
We'll take it.
I mean, like you, I came from a reading family. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a social worker. And I learned to read and enjoy words by reading the paper first, then Sports Illustrated, then, you know, the Chip Hilton series. I'm far older than you, my friend. But they were glad I was reading and writing. So they were okay. And I found my way, and they knew I liked it. And so there was never any pressure. I buried my lead. Congratulations, my friend, on your this is your debut novel, correct?
Yeah, my debut novel. I mean, it's my second book, but debut novel, because publishing likes to say debut novel, even though if you write a novel, then a short story collection, no one says debut short story collection. So it's kind of like funny little debut favoritism. I mean, novel favoritism, but that's a whole other topic.
Okay, speaking of, Nana, maybe you could tell us why this is. We've asked this question of other authors on the show before, David, Claude, et cetera, is that somewhere, and I can't figure out where, it started to appear when a book was a novel. All of a sudden, it appears on the cover now, a novel. Why do publishers feel as though they need to tell us that?
It's 100% weird marketing something. It's because the novels, like they put so much chips into like a novel's what sells, again, especially as opposed to like a poetry collection or a short story collection. They want to like make it, they want to make that distinction. It's not necessary. I don't think it's
okay.
It necessary at all.
It's on the cover, all of them. Okay, wait, let's go back to Syracuse, where, full disclosure, my daughter went there. And just last week, we interviewed Laura Scalzo, who's a Syracuse grad, and there are an incredible number of brilliant writers who have come out of Syracuse. What is it that attracts you brilliant, creative people to a place so far north? It regularly sets the snow record, you know, records every single year. What got you to Syracuse?
Well, there's a couple of things that make writers, I think, attracted to it. On the journalism side, they have the new school, or the journalism
Newhouse.
School.
Newhouse,
sorry. They have Newhouse. So Newhouse is a huge attractive sort of element for people interested in journalism and also in all levels of media. That's one part of it. But for us, there's the MFA program. And the Syracuse MFA program is really attractive for a lot of writers. For me, it was because it's free, and that was the price I could afford. But also the great writers, maybe most notably George Saunders, was there as I was. And that's why I went. That's actually why I chose it, or how I even discovered what MFA was, actually, was by Googling his name and discovering like he taught at whatever an MFA was. And so those are some factors. I think they like to say the fact that it's cold and sometimes there's not so much to do is, it's the one that supports your craft of being inside and writing all day. So maybe that's a part of it too.
Yeah. And are you currently teaching there? I know you have been teaching there.
I'm not teaching. The last 2 years, I haven't been teaching. I sort of missed the pandemic. And so I really do love teaching. I don't know if I'll do it at Syracuse. I don't know if like I have that in me anymore, this weather wise, but I'll probably go back and do a visiting writers here and there.
Cool. Okay. Should we talk about Chain Gang All-Stars, which is spectacular?
Thank you, sir.
What caused you to make, so you, Friday Black got you great critical acclaim, collection of short stories. What made this story, this is by way of, you know, the stupid question is, tell us what the book is about. Mm. Stupid question. That's our Jamie McIntyre question. But what caused you to make the leap to a novel?
Yeah.
And why this story?
If I could have written this as a short story, I absolutely would have. I'm the kind of writer where if I can do a short story, I will. And I actually thought this was going to be a short story for Friday Black, my first book. But once I really got into sort of the pages, it just felt like I couldn't understand how I could speak to the issue of both the carceral state and the situation of the protagonist, Loretta Thurwar, in a concise enough space. Mm-hmm. And so I think I just decided, you know what, I'm going to try for a novel. And it's important for me to say, like, I tried for that without any sense that I do not have a sense that a novel is a more ambitious, inherently and more ambitious endeavor than a short story collection at all. There's a lot of like this hierarchy that I was just talking about. I sort of try to reject it. I'm a big advocate for short fiction. But I did the novel, and that's also, so some people find it almost like you're graduating to a novel. And I'm someone who's like, thinks that I'm just graduating to a second book, and my third book will be a graduation from this, ideally. But yeah, I started to do research on the carceral state and prisons, and it just felt like, even though I started the book before my first one came out, after my first one came out, and I realized, you know what, the second book, for the first time in my life, I knew on some level I'd have an audience, at least a small, some kind of audience. Sure. I wanted to say the most important thing I think I could have said in the little 5 minutes I have the stage. And this book is sort of that that important thing, I think.
One of the greatest, and there's so many fantastic reviews and blurbs of the book, Chain Gang All-Stars. It's like every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings, Nana. Every time you mention the name of the book, somebody buys it. So we try to name the book. Tommy Orange, one of the blurbs said, the incarceration as spectacle. So you're reading about, you're studying, you're researching incarceration. And I said at the start of the show, and it does not do justice to the book, but I said, this is like Hunger Games crossed with The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which is a fantastic book. I mean, I think this book is important, but you're studying incarceration, but where did you get the idea to place it in the context of two women gladiators?
It's hard to say, because those sort of like surrealist conceits, those sort of my first book, like I said, the story collection, there's tons of sort of strange, or maybe at least a first strange seeming ideas and conceits that I work with. I think I wanted to find a way to speak to both like the consumer culture that is interested in even humans as being what is consumed, whether it's through sports or whether it's through reality TV or whatever. I think I was interested in like the reality TV aspect, like, which is another consumption of humans model. And I'm often interested in like capitalism and our consumer capitalist model. And so I think how the fact that for-profit prisons have really blurred that line between the carceral state and, I mean, from the beginning, they blurred the lines between the carceral state and the, and capitalism, and actually capitalism as it exists, depends on the carceral state. I want to sort of make that connection explicit in a way that the public could consume. And so the death matches, the arenas became sort of that metaphor, but it's not like I ever had in my mind, like, okay, capitalism plus prison plus, you know, it just kind of just happened in my mind, but I can like sort of retroactively reverse engineer it and think those things that I'm interested that are always floating around in my mind. Once the piece of the carceral state came in, this is what sort of came out.
Cool. Okay. Are you in terms of writing this, and I want you to tell us all about Thurwar and Stacks, but are you it sounds like it's more organic. Your process is more organic writing this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are you a pantser, as they call it in the literary world? I've come to learn these really big terms, Joe. A pantser, seat of the pants, or did you have index cards spread around your house and, you know, spreadsheets and everything?
So I used to take a lot of pride in being a pantser. You know, I used to like to feel like I don't write from an outline. I discover on the line level or whatever. Uh-huh. But there was a little bit of like ego associated with that. A couple years in, and the story wasn't coming like I needed it to, eventually it became really necessary to make something like outline. And I started outlining. I started, like, probably got a little bit more than halfway through when I started trying to like figure out something like outline. I have a big mirror in my room right now that still has a bunch of Chain Gang like notes and ideas and questions. I'm both, I guess, but because the novel is so big, it's hard to keep the whole thing in your mind's eye at once, which I could do with a short story. Especially because I really like to revise. That's where I think my writing like really grows. Mm-hmm. There's a long period before I could revise because I had to do initial drafting, which took me again several years. So eventually I was just like, you know what, let go of my sort of pantser title and adopt the outline thing. And it helped me a lot, actually.
Cool. Okay, Joe Drake, pantser or organic? Or spreadsheet?
I love your questions and I loved hearing his answers there. And anybody who writes long form wants to know how other people do it. And, you know, what DAA and I do is pantser, because we're on deadlines. We have 20 minutes to write shit.
Right.
You know,
Stop. Flag on the play. Yes, you do. You both do just, you know, covering what happened 3 minutes ago. Great. But you also both write really thoughtful, long form kind of pieces. Mm.
And that is true.
Yeah.
And you know, like him, I've evolved through that. I mean, my first book, after 6 months, I had 7 double space pages, man. And I was just like, my pants wasn't really working at that point. So, right. So you know, I did learn to, I'm a hybrid. I have an idea. I like to outline a couple chapters ahead of where I'm going, but that leaves open a little discovery along the way.
Sure.
And I'm with you also about, you gotta revise. I mean, your first draft, the first draft to me is very important, because it's better to deal with 300 pages of bullshit than it is with 0 blank pages.
So, 100%. Yes.
And so you just kind of go it. My sister gave me a mantra early on in my book career that I've used through all of them. It's like, inch by inch, life's a cinch. Yard by yard, life is hard. So I get up and I say, I'm going to write 1,000 words today, and I'm not going to look back. And sometimes that's 5,000. Maybe sometimes that's 300 and I go see a movie. You just don't have it. So, you know, I love hearing this stuff. And
okay, DA, Panzer, on long form, not covering the Nuggets tonight, blah, blah, blah.
No, long form stuff.
Panzer, yeah, or
some of it. Look, I'm a history major, so I kind of think of things through that lens. So I'm always thinking, well, there's something historical that connects this to something else, to what we're talking about now. This happened before with other people, with other things. And how do we? There's always something. It always happened before, right? There's no new stories, right? But I wouldn't, Nana, it seems to me that this has a lot of Jonathan Swift in it to me. I don't know if it, like, it's like making the abominable tolerable. And it's not, and we're not that far off right now from that. You know, like, there's a saying, the cruelty is the point. You know what I mean? And that seems like the direction we're heading in. And I wonder, when Swift wrote his book, everybody went, well, clearly this is satire. This is a parody. If Swift wrote his book today, I don't know what people would say to him about it. You know, and I wonder, like, did you think about, damn, are they going to get the message here?
Well, absolutely. And also, first, I would say, because I was unfortunately so late and I was rushing through, I just didn't get to say, great, I'm grateful for you all to share this space. And I'm grateful to, like, to speak to you guys about this stuff. Also, it's surreal, David, to talk to you now. I'm a big fan of yours. Like, it's super awesome. Man, I didn't even realize you were going to be here. And it's like, I'm kind of like, how is this happening right now? So very exciting. That's super funny. Sorry. I'm like, it took me a second to be like, oh, this is that David out. It's like, incredible.
Okay, can we just stop there for a second? And if I had a nickel for every time somebody says to me, "Oh my God, David Aldridge, jeez, Louise,"
it's really funny because I didn't even. Great, yeah. That it's a great question. I think a big part of it was because that's why I had the footnotes. I am very afraid of that. I've heard of people who watched something like Squid Game, for example, and never thought about capitalism once. I really fear someone reading this book and being like, it's about a woman killing people with a hammer.
Right.
So I wanted it to be almost impossible to divorce the message or like the book sort of intentionality from itself. Because the footnotes, to be honest, on an autistic level, that feels, I remember reading the, what's his name? He wrote Grendel, the John Gardner, and one of his core tenets is don't break the fictive dream. And I tried to not do that. And footnotes sort of necessarily do that inherently, but it felt necessary to do that because I just couldn't imagine. I just would hate someone to read this book without the context being right there. So it felt really important for me to have the footnotes for that reason. It's a great question.
But talk about that more. Ostensibly, this is about primarily two women gladiators, et cetera. But the footnotes I found had this great, wonderful kind of, bring your attention back to this is real. And the footnotes are about, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what you have learned over the years of the prison system.
Yeah, the footnotes.
Systemic injustices of it.
So the book is about imagined future in which convicted warriors of state can opt out of sentences of at least 25 years and participate in death matches. And this, which feels like really violent and possible. And this book really thinks about how fundamentally, like on a moral ethical level, we aren't that far from that. The reality of the carceral state, the core premises it sort of works on, which is that your humanity is negotiable. We know, as Ava DuVernay has made famous, that slavery was abolished, except and then that exception is explicit in the Constitution in the case of those convicted of crimes. And so with that being true, it's again, it's a fundamental idea that if you do X, we can strip you of your humanity and reduce you to a slave overtly. And so that once that's true, it also allows like sort of all these other atrocities of humanity to exist in within the context of prisons. But also, I think my a part of my like I guess thesis is that also it affects us all outside the walls as well. I don't think you could have a great horror over here and not have it leak out. I did an event in Chicago that in which I spoke with a former warden actually who is now an abolitionist, or at least works in that context, and how she wants to change prisons for the sake of officers and guards, because mm-hmm. their outcomes, their health outcomes, and their life expectancy is much shorter than the average person. Because when you have this violent, loveless space, it infects everything. And so the footnotes really speak to all the different ways, whether it's about the racism, homophobia, transphobia inherent to the system, whether it's about the capitalistic implications, whether it's about the way it cuts at our knees, our ability to respond compassionately to issues like mental health crises or drug addiction, how it individualizes and criminalizes systemic issues like poverty. The footnotes could give me a way to speak very, very directly to all those issues, because the book, besides being about the characters, is about prisons and the carceral state of America.
Yeah. I think the footnotes have a way of really getting people's attention, really getting people's attention. But I want to find, Jerry, so the fight scenes in this, equally jarring, equally, oh my God. I mean, if I were watching this in a Netflix series, and I'm sure it will be a Netflix series or something like that, I'd be, covering my eyes because they are so vivid, incredible. But it was Jerry Nathan, I think, in the New York Times, started his review, his spectacular review of the book, Chain Gang All-Stars, another book just sold. He said, "Should I be having this much fun? To enjoy the action is to share the guilt of the bloodthirsty fans." It's an incredible line. I felt that way. And yeah. I was reading the book going, okay, this is an important book, but I'm reading this going, I can see this fight scene unfolding. As you were writing it, did you have any mixed feelings about it?
Absolutely. There's a lot, and not just in the fight scenes, but throughout the book, it's really a dive into like a lot of different types of darkness to write a book like this. The actual fight scenes, the initial drafting that is before the revision, is almost like a very particular kind of choreography that I felt more like a choreographer than someone witnessing the violence of the scenes unfold in the moment. It's the comparison I've been trying to give people recently is like, if you've ever done yoga, a yoga instructor is pretty, because like a helpful like analog to thinking about writing high action scenes. Because in prose, it's hard to write a lot of action. If you think about like a basketball game, it's hard to describe something like that in text. But in yoga, for example, they give you really specific limb specific directions about how to move your body, right? And in the fight scenes, that's sort of what I'm doing. Because I could say someone threw a punch, but that's not really, that won't feel to me, that won't feel very evocative, or it won't arrive in the reader's mind's eye very clearly. But if I say she planted her foot, her left foot, and then and twisted, but no, she turned at her torso, hinging on her hip, her shoulder drew back before her forearm shot forward, and then by giving the component parts, which is again like a yoga instructor does something similar but in a nicer way, but I'm more thinking about that choreography. But in terms of the book as this whole, understanding like it's logically that I'm putting these characters in these really difficult, harsh situations, and some of those situations aren't as spectacle as the fight scenes, maybe they're more quiet moments, they're all of it has a sort of edge of really intense darkness that I try to care about, because I try to be really compassionate and thoughtful with how the characters are being treated. And so I try to be intentional all the way through with what they're being exposed to.
A follow-up to that, and then a question to Joe and to David in terms of your cover. Okay, one of the things I found remarkable about those fight scenes is, and I mean, did you, and have you done, you know, what sports have you yourself participated in?
I played basketball. I've done track. I've done a little bit of, when I was at Syracuse, just on the other club, a boxing club. I've done a little bit of that because I was writing the book.
Maybe I was, again, I know just enough about this stuff to, you know, be dangerous, but your descriptions of the physicality of it, how the body had to turn, how the shoulders had to compensate for the center, whatever. But at the same time, you never lost sight of, and you certainly wrote the what was going through the fighters' minds at the same time. I found incredible to just, again, every single page. I don't know which review I read, but it was true. You can just pull any page from this book, Jing Yang All-Stars, and every page is beautiful. And I found that remarkable. Joe, have you ever pulled back? I mean, this is horrible, given we spent 35 minutes on horse racing before you joined us, Nana, about which I care deeply. But Joe, have you ever pulled back on one of the descriptions of what happens when these poor creatures break down the track?
No, I don't, because that is my opportunity to show how much is at stake here. And I'm loving your line of questioning. And what I want to know from you is, what was your pop culture growing up diet? Because you've taken a very serious,
great question,
thoughtful, and you've made it entertaining, you know, in mine and David's world, you made chicken salad out of chicken shit. Okay. So what informed that vividness? Yeah.
So it's a really great question. I think some people who I talk sometimes in interviews about, like, I've watched a lot of anime and I read a lot of manga, which is like, it might be like comics, but from Japan. And one of the things that is really important in the manga and anime that I like is, even as like a fight is unfolding, even it's kind of the fight is almost like a political debate. Usually like in like a really, like, so I'm used to both high action and serious, more ethical debate happening sometimes on the same exact page because of these manga and this anime that I used to watch. We used to almost joke about like how they'd be like these long speeches in the middle of fights because the characters are in those kind, in that tradition, which is getting more Eastern flavored, like the fight is not just because I don't like you. It's we're at a real impasse. And so the fight has to happen, which is really different in my mind from like, and that's like, I've been using this example. I think it's sort of reductive. I'm not trying to like, and I think there's a time and place for whatever, but like in a John Wick, for example, like one person does something and then it kind of justifies him killing however many 2,000 people he's shot by the time that series is gone from 1 to 4 or whatever. But that's a different thing. It's like gun fu, it's kind of ha-ha fun, and that's whatever. But I've seen pretty violent things engage serious, more ethical topics from a child. I've seen that, for whether it's Dragon Ball Z or Naruto or more serious stuff like Attack on Titan is a show that people like now. It involves giants and violence and it's dark, but it actually is really like a meditation on all types of violences. And so I'm used to that. And that's pop culturally probably the thing that trained me to know that I don't have to pick and choose.
Very cool. Okay, David, I've got what I think is a good get him out with this question, but do you have a question, comment?
I was fascinated by some of the characters in the book, and I wondered about one of the protesters, and you did a great job of kind of explaining how he became a protester. He wasn't down for this at all. And all of the things that people asked him in college, or the things they assumed about him in college, kind of oriented him to this new reality. And I was thinking, this sounds like, I think Nana has experienced this in his life, like having to kind of go a different path than other people have gone. I wonder if there was any of that in that character or in any of the characters in this book. Like, this is something I have to do on my own. Like, I can't, y'all can't come.
Yeah, it's a really great reading. I mean, and yes, so that character Niall in the book talking about his experience with activism early on, especially in the college context. So yeah, I was in college when Trayvon Martin was murdered. Mm-hmm. And like many of us, that was sort of an activation point for us. I remember me and my best friend secretly made like a bunch of pamphlets, and that was sort of like talking about racism, whatever. And we threw them all over the place in the middle of the night, like 4 a.m. And I had a sort of self-righteous glee when I went to bed, like, well, I solved racism today. And I went to bed thinking that. And, you know, unsurprisingly, I did not. There was no New World Order I had ushered in. And so that was tough. And so I think I have experienced that on some level, but also I've experienced the opposite, which is finding great community and people who are trying to do things and working in that way and figuring it out.
Very cool. Here's my get you out with this question, but we are going to subject you to 60 seconds more, which your people may not have warned you about.
Yes.
The review in Wired, and it said, quote, "You are a builder of worlds dark and twistedly terrifying, but never devoid of hope." Which is a great line. So are you an optimistic person? And if so, why? And those people who cannot see your hat on late, a better world is coming. So I think you've answered my question. But are you an optimistic person? And if so, why?
I think one of my best self, I am. I mean, I think people like go move in waves. I think hope is a discipline, and you can grow it if you try. And so I think it's not, I am an optimist, but it's because I have done research and followed behind people like Albert Woodfox. He spent 43 years in solitary confinement, and he still thinks it's worth fighting, or when he was alive, thought it was still fighting, worth fighting for. So who am I to be like, oh no, this is unsalvageable? You know, because I've seen a lot of beauty. I've seen a lot of incredible work that people are doing and are always doing. I just came off a couple of days ago off 19 flights in 20 days for the book tour. And, you know, I've seen that there are so many people all over this country who really believe that we can do better. And so if people believe it, I think it's possible. So I am an optimist, truly.
Excellent. And I think the more people who read your book, the more optimistic people there will be out there. Okay. Again, your people, Josie, God bless you, who helped make this happen. Josie and I have exchanged a lot of text today. So thank you, Josie, for making this happen.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay. The book is Chain Gang All-Stars. Everyone should go out and buy it at their favorite stores. Yeah,
thank you so much, guys. I really do appreciate the time.
Yes.
No, thank you. Go on to your next gig. We're going to do some homework. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Really fabulous. Fabulous book. Totally Netflix series written all over it.
Oh, I'm so excited to read it. I ordered it on Amazon today.
Right? I'm not exaggerating. You could just pull out any single page and go, well, that was fun to read. And that was fun to read. And I don't know enough to describe the way he writes, but every sentence has a purpose.
Well,
thank you. That's it. Okay. We got to get out of this, because it's like midnight here for people who. Where does anybody have? I'm in DC.
Oh, you're back?
Yeah,
I didn't know where you were.
Yeah, I'm back. Okay, we got to do Father's Day book recommendations, because we get these emails from our listeners, God bless them, and they want recommendations. David, you go first. Lily, I didn't tell you, but I'm putting the pressure on you too. Father's Day book recommendations. Yes, David, first.
I would Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I think it's It's a fantastic nice. Book for fathers and sons.
Nice, Joe.
I'm old school. Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner.
Oh, good one. Nice. Stegner's good. Excellent. Nice. Lily?
Working at a toy store, there's this really cute book called I Heart My Dad by the Hungry Caterpillars.
Nice.
There we go.
Nice.
Excellent. Excellent selection.
That is fantastic. Okay, I swear to God, I put this question out there and I thought it about, 2 hours ago. I didn't even come up with anything. So, of course, I go to ChatGPT.
Of course you do.
Got my answer to everything now. And they came up with Chain Gang All-Stars.
There you go.
Several books. Chain Gang All-Stars was in the top of the list. So there's my recommendation for Father's Day.
There you
okay,
go.
We are off next week, but then we come back the week after with Irish Yamashita, who's a really, really interesting person with all sorts of interesting background. But she's got this book. It's a novel, which they put across the front of the book so we can see that. It's called City Under One Roof, Live Together, Die Alone, which is about a murder in a small Alaska town in a building. It's spectacular. So we're back with her. Joe, David, Claude, Lily, that's just the order in which you are across the top of my screen. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your patience with time. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. We're out.